Good afternoon, folks, and welcome back once again to another edition of the Come Out of Her My People show. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and as I was thinking about how to put together the show for this week, it occurred to me that I've spent a lot of time over recent weeks and months, especially when it came to news stories, talking about the circus courts, the kangaroo courts, even the Kardashian courts, if you remember some of the old Star Trek episodes, where we've seen a court system that has come so far away from even the concept of the rule of law that it's way beyond even being a joke. And in a lot of cases, it's just plain outright satanic. In places like Georgia and in New York, they don't even try to hide it anymore. They're literally rubbing people's noses in it. Sometimes I really don't think they even expect you to believe that they're trying to play by their own rules. And yet, at other times, we do kind of get a clue, at least, that maybe the rules really are as carefully crafted and exquisitely well hidden as it seems. I've done entire shows and had guests on, like Harmon Taylor and others, talking about the rule of law, the law of the sea versus the law of the land, or the law of the city. Private law, corporate law, maritime law, call it what you like, but what it's very clearly not is anything associated with Scripture or the written law and the instruction of the Creator. This part I've said over and over again for as long as I've been doing this show. Understand that we have a choice. Deuteronomy 30 lays it out very clearly. I have laid before you this day, says the Creator, life and death, blessing and cursing. So choose life. And along with choosing life, folks, comes choice of law. And what we really kind of have a difficult time wrapping our heads around is the fact that His written law, His instruction for us, is clear. We literally can choose it. And if we choose the alternative, and oh, don't believe for a second, Big Brother isn't going to make it almost impossible not to, unless you really know what you're doing, well, then you are subject to an entirely different jurisdiction, foreign to what was once called our Constitution and laws. As Harmon Taylor puts it, it's by agreement. You've made the deal with the devil, and guess what? There's a whole lot of baggage goes along with it. Which takes me directly to part one of where I intend to go today. The increasingly laughably misnamed U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments Monday on a case that has a number of names, originally called Murphy versus Missouri. It's more popularly known now as Missouri v. Biden. And in a tweet after it came out, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky called the case the most consequential free speech case in U.S. history. Quote, "This isn't just about social media companies. It's a critical examination of government overreach. The Biden regime," he spelled it wrong, "and FBI efforts to influence big tech into silencing dissent tramples on the First Amendment. Our focus," he continued, "must be on preventing government censorship, not compelling private entities to act as censors. This case," he said, "could redefine our free speech," unquote, or obviously, folks, the lack thereof. In the Gateway Pundit's coverage, and they're one of the plaintiffs in the case, they shared excerpts from oral arguments made by U.S. Supreme Court Justice, sick and double sick in her case, Ketanji Brown Jackson, the alleged female who doesn't know what a woman is, but still gets to wear a black robe and tell everybody else what they can and cannot say, whose comments about the First Amendment, they note, and this is true, folks, literally rocked socialist media. Quote, "And make sure you're sitting down for this one. I realize as I read through this, I'm probably going to have to take a break now and again." Quote, "My biggest concern is that your view," she said, addressing the plaintiff's lawyer, "has the First Amendment hamstringing the government." Well, gee, you idiot! That's the whole point of the First Amendment. Indeed, the entirety of the Bill of Rights. It's a prohibition specifying what Big Brother cannot do. And some of these idiots completely missed the whole point. They shouldn't even be there, but that's another issue. "My concern," she said, "is that your view," yeah, by the way, the view of the founders who wrote, "Congress shall make no law," "has the First Amendment hamstringing the government in significant ways at the most important time," unquote. And what's the most important time? Yeah, when we want to kill you with lethal injections and lie to you about what it is that may end up killing you otherwise. The most important time. That's when it's most important people should be allowed to speak and hear information that is true, not government approved and Ministry of Truth regulated. But back to the quote here. I mean, what would you have the government do? I'd have them shut the hell up and keep the hell out of business that they are prohibited from having anything to say about anyway. But hey, that's just those of us that can read a document I don't think she's ever even opened the page to. This she asked Louisiana Solicitor General Benjamin Aguinaga. But if you thought that was stupid, just wait. She's on a roll. I've heard you say a couple of times, this blithering moron continued, that the government can post its own speech. But in the hypothetical, you know, kids, this is not safe. Don't do it is not going to get it done. In other words, if we want to cut off your genitalia, having your parents say, don't do it, is not going to get it done. They might even post things that we don't want you little kiddies, or you American citizens, to be allowed to read. That is exactly, folks, what she's talking about here. We'll come back to that in a minute. But for now, let's just continue with this idiotic quote. So, I guess some might say that the government actually has a duty to take steps to protect the citizens of this country. Their poor little brains can't handle things that we don't want them to know, don't you know? And you, she told the attorney for the plaintiffs, seem to be suggesting that that duty, no, it's a prohibited act, folks, cannot manifest itself in the government, encouraging or even pressuring platforms to take down harmful information. And you're damn right, you blithering idiot. That's exactly what the First Amendment says. You don't have any lawful authority whatsoever to decide what can and cannot be spoken and who gets to coerce others to censor information you don't want them to have for you. And as the Gateway Pundit put it, commenting on this idiocy, quote, that's the most horrifying thing I've ever heard from a Supreme Court justice. And that, folks, is closer to the truth than anything out of Ketanji Brown Jackson's lips. But on this score, everybody can see it. Ketanji Brown Jackson is concerned that this pesky First Amendment thing is making it harder for Big Brother to censor speech. To use Orwell's terminology, their Ministry of Truth just can't have pesky things like this getting in the way of what they need to accomplish. How else do you think we're going to be able to give you the Zyklon B injections, force you to get on the train, or even prevent you from having life-saving information that we tried so hard to prevent you before and managed to kill a few million people in the process about things like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin? This is satanic evil, folks. Let's not kid ourselves. And the fact that there are openly tyrannical traitors sitting on this court wearing black robes having this discussion in plain sight rather than simply saying, you've got to be kidding me, who the hell do you think you are trying to pull this kind of crap, FBI and CDC and Biden-Fuhrer Ministry of Truth? If we had a rule of law, they'd have actually been convicted already. Under the U.S. Criminal Code, Title 18, Section 242, that has to do with deprivation of once constitutionally protected rights under color of law. Ironically, folks, I looked it up this morning. The FBI's own site says that this statute makes it a crime for them or any other, quote, person acting under color of law, statute, ordinance, regulation, or custom to willfully deprive, and don't think for a second they didn't know damn well what they were doing, or cause to be deprived, any person, the rights, privileges, or immunities secured or protected by, yeah, the Constitution for these United States. And given that they caused a whole lot of deaths, for example, by withholding information about ivermectin so they could aid and abet the big lie and make sure they called it an emergency with no other treatment options available, yeah, sure, and mandating that a lot of people take a Zyklon B injection without informed consent, they are liable, all of those involved, for jail time up to and including life, oh yeah, and the death penalty for a whole lot of murders. Why is the Supreme Court saying anything different? In fairness, though, not all of the black robe priests of another god were complete idiots. In one of the most blistering exchanges in the oral arguments on Tuesday, says the Gateway Pundit, U.S. Justice, and he at least deserves the title, Samuel Alito appeared to be admonishing Big Brother for treating socialist media platforms like their subordinates. In his comments, Justice Alito referenced, quote, the exchange between the White House and other federal officials and to Facebook in particular, but also some of the other platforms, and he continued, and I see that the White House and other federal officials are repeatedly saying that Facebook, sick, and the federal government should be partners. Isn't that fascism in action, folks? The very definition? Back to Alito. I.e., we're on the same team. Officials are demanding answers. I want an answer, he said. I want it right away. And when they're unhappy, they curse them out. There are regular meetings there, and the constant pestering of Facebook and some of the other platforms, and they want to have regular meetings, and they suggest rules that should be applied and tell us everything that you do so we can help you and we can look it over. And I thought, wow, I cannot imagine federal officials taking that approach to the print media or representatives over there. If you did that to them, what do you think the reaction would be? Well, if it's the New York Times or WAPO folks, they'll say, thank you, sir, may I have another, and go ahead and do it again, and lie about it to the public besides. Anyway, back to Alito. I thought he said, you know, the only reason why this is taking place is because the federal government has got Section 230 and antitrust in its pocket. And to mix my metaphors, it's got these big clubs available to it. And so it's treating these platforms like they're subordinates. Would you do that, he said, to the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Associated Press or any other big newspaper or wire service? Unquote. And yeah, folks, sadly, asked and answered. Anyway, he asked this to U.S. Principal Deputy Solicitor General Brian Fletcher, Menachemo, who was defending the anti-First Amendment censorship practices of Big Brother and Big Tech and using the so-called once-in-a-lifetime plandemic as the excuse for destroying and killing people in the interest of, you know, the greater good and all the other crap that Big Brother uses to say you slaves don't have any rights. For some more detail next on the specifics of the so-called arguments, we'll go to the Epoch Times and authors like first Matthew Vadim and then Zachary Stiber. Wrote Vadim, Supreme Court justices sick seem skeptical of state arguments, that would be the state of Louisiana and Missouri, on March 18th, that the FedGov was wrong to communicate with socialist media platforms about what they laughably called public health issues during the recent pandemic. At the same time, during oral argument in Murphy v. Missouri, a.k.a. folks, Missouri v. Biden, the states argued that the FedGov strong-armed socialist media companies into censoring disfavored views on important public issues, like side effects related to the COVID-19 not vaccine. I'm going to correct a couple of little errors in here as we go through it. And the pandemic lockdowns. Applying this kind of pressure, said the states, violates the First Amendment. And I have to add, you're damn right it does. Next, he said Dr. Vivek Murthy, sick, is, sadly, U.S. Surgeon General. The state of Missouri and other parties sued the FedGov for alleged censorship by pressuring socialist media companies to suppress certain disfavored content that would have hurt their public-private partners, like Pfizer, Moderna, and Big Brother CDC, not to mention globalist plans for genocide on a massive scale. Said Vadim, conservatives and others have complained that socialist media censors information about transgender issues, COVID-19, and the rigged 2020 election. They were particularly concerned about coverage of Hunter Biden's laptop. Well, non-coverage is a better way to put it. That contained information, they say, almost certainly, and everybody knows it, would have harmed the rigged election that installed the senile guy, the Biden-Fuhrer, in the White House, had it been allowed to actually get out. Or as the Epoch Times puts it, had it been allowed to actually circulate freely. Does anybody actually doubt that that's true at this point? It's just a bit too late, isn't it? Damage done, regime in place, criminal government installed, and now we're suppressing any truth about what actually was done, and if we get our way with the First Amendment, we'll make sure it never comes out. And this is precious, but also satanically evil, Brian Fletcher, that scumbag principal deputy solicitor general of the United States, and guess what he solicits, folks, acknowledged that the government, quote, may not use coercive threats, ha ha ha, but it all depends on what the meaning of threat is, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, to suppress speech. But he argued that Big Brother was entitled to speak for himself by informing, persuading, or criticizing private speakers, or if necessary, folks, silencing them and maybe making sure they stay silent. He said, quote, there's a fundamental distinction between persuasion and coercion. And if you do not know the difference, they have ways of making you not talk. And listen to this insanely evil claim. Fletcher is upset that the states of Missouri and Louisiana plus five individuals are daring to try to use the federal courts to, quote, audit all of the executive branch's communications with social media platforms, unquote. Those are privilege coercions, don't you know? The problem, he said, has, quote, infected every step of this case. Respondents don't have standing at all because how dare they think that they have a right to listen in when we coerce our subordinates? No, he said, they've not shown an imminent threat. You mean besides all the bodies that are piled up here? Oh, come on. They have not shown an imminent threat that the government will cause a platform to moderate their posts in particular.
Are you crazy? Or just plain stupid?
Stupid is stupid does, Miss Blue.
I guess.
That bit of idiocy at least prompted Justice Neil Gorsuch to ask Fletcher if Biden's statement that socialist media companies are, quote, responsible for killing people, if they don't alter their policies, might be considered coercive. Lying Fletcher claimed it wasn't. Of course, neither is ordering an intern to get naked on his desk if they know what's good for him. It's just friendly persuasion by one of your betters. This regime really does think you're stupid. And if you figure it out, they know. What are you going to do about it anyway? Tweet? The same lying minion from hell told Justice Clarence Thomas that the government is allowed to, quote, persuade, ha ha, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, private parties. Again, that is, if they know what's good for them. And here's an irony for you. If this is offensive, folks, so be it, because this whole damn discussion is. This is the same government that argues people have a right to kill their kids if they have been raped. Arguably, with far less persuasive tactics than that. Justice Alito again correctly pushed back, suggesting that when the Big Brother government uses its heavy hand to approach socialist media companies, the two sides were not equal in power. And he added, emails from the White Whorehouse and other federal officials to socialist media platforms showed that there was, quote, constant pestering of Facebook and some of the other platforms, he said. And he even paraphrased some of those communications to add, quote, why don't you just tell us everything that you're going to do so we can help you and we can look it over, unquote.
I want you to rest well, and a month from now, this Hollywood big shot's going to give you what you want. I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
And as we've already noted, but it certainly bears repeating, Justice Alito noted that Big Brother has Section 230 of the so-called Communications Decency Act and various antitrust tools in its pocket, and he said they have these big clubs available to it, and so he said they're treating Facebook and these other platforms like their subordinates, unquote. And if necessary, folks, they can always put a horse's head in their bed, remember?
I'm going to make them an offer he can't refuse.
Said Louisiana Solicitor General, the evidence shows that there was unrelenting pressure by Big Brother to, quote, coerce social media platforms to suppress the speech of millions of Americans, unquote. And everybody listening who isn't absolutely brain dead knows that's true. How bad was it? Well, even the federal district court reviewing the case described the government's behavior during the period they examined as, quote, the most massive attack against free speech in American history, including the censorship of renowned scientists operating in their areas of expertise, unquote. Said Mr. Aguinaga, the government's levers of pressure are anathema to the First Amendment. Now, this, folks, is where some of the stench gets a bit deeper. Justice Amy Coney Barrett, appointed by Donald Trump, offered the scenario of Louisiana state officials being doxxed with their private information being posted online. And while this might have fallen short of being illegal in and of itself, the FBI came to the rescue. They saw the post, and they alerted the socialist media outfits, saying that the posts were significantly threatening. Said Justice Barrett in her hypothetical, should the court block the FBI from doing that? And she added, do you know how often the FBI engages in that type of communication? You know what, folks? And all I can add to that is, I wonder how often the FBI threatens to do exactly that to those who won't knuckle under to their persuasive tactics. Good grief. Let me ask this. I wonder if those people who got doxxed, oh, how awful that might be, have anything to say to those of us who almost died or, in fact, lost relatives and loved ones because these damnable traitors lied and censored information that would have saved lives, whether it's the side effects of Zyklon B or the efficacy of ivermectin, or now wanting to kill you with climate restrictions and cutting off your access to energy, food, little things that you might need somewhere down the line. Now, here, though, sadly, the Louisiana attorney waffled a bit, saying that the hypotheticals are important, but he had a backup answer, allowing Justice Barrett to reply, that's kind of falling back on, well, this case is different, and so a different legal standard should apply. But what we say in this case, she said, matters for other cases, too, unquote, and yeah, duh. At least finally at this point, Mr. Aguinaga recovered a bit and saying, yeah, it does, but if what the FBI is doing to try to persuade an intermediate speech intermediary to take down a private third-party speech, I mean, that's what's covered by the plain text of Norwood, he said, referring to Norwood v. Harrison. And he added, that's an abridgment of speech, noting that the plain text of Norwood v. Harrison had the Supreme Court finding that, quote, a state may not induce, encourage, or promote private persons, that would include corporate entities, folks, according to what passes for law, to accomplish what it is constitutionally forbidden to accomplish, unquote. Justice John Roberts, sadly a Bush appointee, later offered another hypothetical, invoking the EPA, as he questioned Mr. Aguinaga. How do you analyze a situation where maybe EPA is trying to coerce the platform and the Army Corps of Engineers is trying to coerce them the other way? In other words, Big Brother's right hand doesn't know what his left hand is forcing down the people's throats. And he actually came out and said this, quote, it's not monolithic, and that has to dilute the concept of coercion significantly, doesn't it? Unquote. What a blithering idiot. I mean, folks, it's a bit like the Corleone family versus the Gambino versus the Genovese family. Which gang family's speech prevails? Said the eminently blackmailable Justice Roberts, I mean, you can't just sort of pick and choose which part of the government you're concerned about. Unquote. And said the Louisiana attorney, when a platform takes down speech under pressure from the government, that's a square First Amendment issue, which prompted some of the other sycophants, like Justices Sick Kagan and Brett Kavanaugh, to raise just how government officials contact news organizations regarding sensitive stories. I don't know, like maybe a senile president, you think? Quote, this still happens now, said Kagan. Decades ago it happened all the time, which is somebody from the White House got in touch with somebody from the WAPO and said, this will just harm national security. And the Washington Post said, okay, whatever you say, said Kagan. She added, was that coercion? To which the obvious answer, folks, is you're damn right it was. But they got away with it then. That seems to be Kagan's point. Why can't we keep getting away with it now? Kavanaugh imagined Post offering inaccurate information about what U.S. troops are doing, asking, why should you be publishing that inaccurate information? Unquote. Well, you know what, folks? I guess it really boils down to, it's about who gets to decide what's inaccurate and who gets to define truth. And if you don't like it, you can just shut the hell up, or maybe worse, especially once we manage to both silence you and disarm you. And this is certainly worth pointing out, as the Epoch Times does, documents unearthed by state officials and other individuals who've challenged Big Brother's conduct have shown federal officials applying pressure on platforms to remove supposed misinformation, malinformation, or anything else that they don't like, including posts about Mr. Biden's laptop and COVID-19 vaccine effectiveness, and you name it, folks, so much other BS that they say is true and settled science and you name it, but you're not allowed to, as it turns out. Anyway, the documents show, quote, a massive effort by defendants from the White House to federal agencies to suppress speech based on its content. And this was a ruling from a federal judge, no less. Lower courts have blocked the Biden-Fuhrer regime from working with big tech firms, public, private, partners, all, to censor posts. But in 2023, when the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case, they stayed those orders and let the censorship continue. And sometime, maybe by June or so, if you're lucky, Big Brother's Supreme Court will let you know whether you can still speak or not. And as we wrap it up, there is this. Attorneys General Liz Merrill of Louisiana and Andrew Bailey of Missouri both told the Epoch Times that they felt positive about the case and how the justices reacted. Said Merrill, I'm cautiously optimistic that we'll have a majority of the court that lands where I wholeheartedly believe they should land, and that is in favor of protecting speech. Meanwhile, Dr. Aaron Cariotti and journalist Jim Hoft, both parties listed in the case, spoke about how their own personal losses could be viewed by the court, and both said they believed that at least some of the justices seemed to understand their plight. Quote, clearly, several of the justices grasp what is at stake. They reviewed the evidentiary record carefully, and I'm optimistic that they will do the right thing, said Dr. Cariotti to the Epoch Times. For his part, said Jim Hoft, this has to be where they put a stop to this. The government shouldn't be doing this, especially when they're wrong and pushing their own opinion, silencing dissenting voices. Of course, it's against the Constitution. It's a no-brainer, unquote. Which means, of course, there's no telling what this bunch of sellouts will actually do. But it also means, folks, that it's a great litmus test, as well as a real indicator of exactly what we need to be paying attention to today. You've heard it said the devil is in the details, and guess what? The devil's course will help to teach us what those details are. Do the peons have a right to free speech at all? Does it matter if the peons try to use corporate entities, mouthpieces, controlled and run and created directly by the satanic forces themselves? And that's where we'll pick it up next, right after this bottom of the hour break. Stay with us.
Wonder I can think at all, and my lack of education hasn't hurt me none. I can read the writing on the wall.
Welcome back now to the second segment of the show for this evening, and having spent the first one talking a bit about the concept of whether or not free speech still exists and who gets to have free speech or what form of law, whether you know it or not, you are subject to, let's talk now about the Second Amendment. There are a whole lot of issues that are very much related. Most people would say the First and Second Amendments are kind of the cornerstone of liberty and that they would apply to the people who have those once constitutionally protected rights. But guess what, folks? Turns out there's a whole heck of a lot more to it, whether it's supposed to be that way or not. And all of this will really help, I believe, frame the question of, well, who is to be master, that is all, whether it's God or the God of this world, and whose law we choose this day to serve. Let me say this up front. The prince of this world may presume we serve him, but that's a rebuttable presumption. And ultimately, we need to be able to make it clear who we serve and which choice of law. So here we go again. Next, I want to go to a story that's raising some eyebrows and certainly raising some questions as well. And in a way, it really helps to clarify some of the issues I want to talk about today. Because no doubt about it, you can think of this as a double-edged sword that cuts both ways. And the trouble is, a lot of the conservative pundits that are looking at it aren't seeing the bigger picture. The piece from Jim Hoft at the Gateway Pundit is kind of typical. It says that an Obama-appointed judge has ruled that illegal immigrants can carry guns in the United States. And no doubt about it, folks, a lot of us would tend to focus on that and say, hey, U.S. citizens can't, certainly not everywhere, and certainly not without permission from their masters. Certainly American slaves can't, but illegal invaders? Yeah, that doesn't seem to be inconsistent at all with what the regime is trying to accomplish. The story concerns an Obama-appointed U.S. District Judge named Sharon Johnson Coleman from the U.S. District Court, Northern District of Illinois, who's ruled that an illegal immigrant has the right, under the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution, to keep and bear arms. And you know what, folks? If you read the text, turns out that the text has nothing to do with whether somebody is or isn't a U.S. citizen or anything of the sort. The text just simply says the right of the people, whatever that means, and we'll come back to that, to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. I'll say it again. It is a clear, explicit, undeniable, and overwhelming prohibition on this central government thing in any way, shape, or form to infringe. And that means fold, spindle, mutilate, or in any way try to prohibit, tax, exercise prior restraint, regulate, or even comment on the God-given and supposedly constitutionally protected by this wording right of the people to keep and bear arms. The trouble is, the prohibition is explicit and universal. So what they've been doing, at least since prohibition, is infringing it in various ways. And now the question is, how can they justify it? How can they keep doing it? How can they make it look like they're not when, in fact, they are and they intend to accelerate that process? Again, the Second Amendment clearly says the right of the people. Does that have anything to do with so-called U.S. citizens? No. And note again, there are lots of definitions for that term, and that is a big part, intentionally, of the problem. Does the verbiage seem to include anybody with a pulse? You bet. But that's where the plot thickens. And oh yeah, I'll remind you again up front of what I've said many, many times and will continue to. Can you trade your God-given rights for a little temporary security? Can you trade, as Esau did in Scripture, your birthright for a cup of pottage? Answer to all of the above, yes. And people have, whether they know it or not. So let's start with the specifics of this case and then see if, did this judge make a mistake by letting some of the truth actually slip out? Says Jim Hoff's story for the Gateway Pundit, this ruling came about in the case of Heriberto Carbajal Flores, who faces charges under 18 United States Code Section 922, subparagraph G5, a federal statute, lawful or not, that prohibits non-citizens without legal status in the U.S., among others, from possessing or affecting in commerce any, quote, firearm or ammunition, or to receive any firearm or ammunition which has been shipped or transported in interstate or foreign commerce, unquote. And boy, did you see all the terms of art in that one? Carbajal Flores, who'd been living in the United States illegally, was charged in the spring of 2020 during the civil unrest in Chicago after he was found carrying a gun in the gun-free killing zone there. He and his lawyers, and I guess it's fair to wonder who paid for those, have been fighting the charge, arguing that his gun was for self-defense, and citing that Supreme Court ruling in New York State Rifle and Pistol Association, Inc. v. Bruin, sometimes it's just called Bruin, which found that New York's law was unconstitutional, duh, and that the ability to carry a pistol in public was a constitutionally protected right. Well, at least for some people. And here we go again, because therein lies the rub. On March 8th, the judge, Coleman, concurred with Carbajal Flores' defense, stating that his nonviolent history and adherence to the conditions of his pretrial release, notice that being an illegal didn't seem to have much to do with it, demonstrated he did not pose a public safety risk, and the judge's ruling claims, therefore, that the statute under which Carbajal Flores was charged does not align, listen carefully, with the nation's historical tradition, and that was the term used in the Supreme Court ruling in Bruin, of firearm regulation, and therefore cannot be used to strip him of his Second Amendment rights. Quote, the government argues that Carbajal Flores is a non-citizen who is unlawfully present in this country. Funny, folks, which part of the government would argue that and which part would say, come on in? Anyway, the court notes, continuing with the quote, that Carbajal Flores has never been convicted of a felony, although, never mind, a violent crime or any crime involving the use of a weapon. Even in the present case, Carbajal Flores contends that he received and used a handgun solely for self-protection and protection of property during that time of documented civil unrest, wrote Coleman. And the court therefore finds he does not pose a risk to public safety such that he cannot be trusted to use a weapon responsibly and should not be deprived of his Second Amendment right to bear arms in self-defense. Now, you may be thinking, and I wouldn't argue with you, that if he was a Constitution-carrying Christian or a Bible believer or anybody else that the FBI and regime Fuhrer would call a domestic violent extremist, that'd be a whole different story. You might be right, but we'll put that aside, at least for now. Biden doesn't seem to think anybody can use a firearm responsibly, unless perhaps they're an MS-13 or Communist Chinese Party PLA Special Forces member. And note, folks, no doubt about it, all this cynicism is warranted and certainly part, at least, of the bigger picture, if not necessarily the explicit legal issues. So, the court finds, as applied to this illegal alien, that Section 922 G5 is unconstitutional. Let that sink in for a second. Oh yeah, and here's the next line. Cynicism continues to be warranted. Critics argue that it sets a dangerous precedent that undermines public safety. You see, even if it's one of our precious illegals, but somebody, anybody has the God-given constitutionally protected right to keep and bear arms, that's a problem. And I think at least on that score, they're starting to see why. People are asking the question, and I'd think justifiably so, what about Communist Chinese Party People's Liberation Army invaders or other terrorists who happen to be here illegally but haven't been convicted on these shores of a violent crime, much less a felony? And hey, if you've been paying attention, you know that Big Brother Biden's Department of Justice ain't about to. They're going to let them go. They're going to let them continue to rape or kill people like Lake and Riley. They don't even want you to talk about it. So you can see, folks, why this is a big deal, and people are not only rightfully upset about it, but maybe even hugely confused. And that's why it's important, and we'll go through it. Here are some of the details from the decision itself, which makes lots of references to Bruin, and especially the question of analyzing the historical tradition, and how and why a given regulation might burden gun rights. And interestingly, folks, the word infringe doesn't even appear directly in here. And maybe that shouldn't surprise us. So here's where the rubber meets the road. The Second Amendment, Section B of the decision, says in Bruin, the Supreme Court established a framework for analyzing whether a challenged firearm regulation violates the Second Amendment. Now, if shall not be infringed matters, the answer is we already know that. But the court says, it's not quite so simple, and aren't they good at making things that are simple complicated? First, says this decision, Bruin instructs courts to determine whether the Second Amendment's plain text covers an individual's conduct. Shall not be infringed. Okay. Well, if it does, the conduct is presumptively protected, they put it in quotes, and the government bears the burden of demonstrating that the challenged regulation is, and here we listen carefully, consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearms regulation or infringement. But we don't use the word firearm. It says arms in general. Isn't that another clever distinction? In other words, what does shall not mean today? And let's try to look at the history and see if that doesn't give us at least a bit of an excuse for continuing down the same path. The court looks at its previous rulings about Carbajal Flores and then says that although the Second Amendment's plain text presumptively protects firearms possession by undocumented persons, isn't it wonderful to be undocumented when it really helps, that does not end the analysis. Under Bruin, if the government can show that the felon dispossession statute is part of the country's historical tradition of firearms regulation, then the statute survives. Thus, we're going to take a look at the historical tradition with respect to guidance from a case that's called Atkinson. We'll come back to that in a second, too. There's what's called a writ of cert that may have some bearing with the Supreme Court in progress there. But here's what I think constitutes the next bit of interesting verbiage from this decision. The government argues that the historic record establishes that legislatures in the past categorically disarmed, number one, individuals who were not members of the political community, and number two, individuals who threatened the social order through their untrustworthy adherence to the rule of law, unquote. And wait a minute, that would disqualify most of Congress and all of the swamp. Obviously, folks, they ain't going to look there any further. But it certainly does cause your host to suggest, and by the way, not for the first time, that I could make a pretty compelling case that every single damned U.S. representative, congressman, senator, or fake president who put their hand on a Bible and lied has demonstrated their untrustworthy adherence to the rule of law, not to mention their oath, which is another thing that shows up repeatedly in these Second Amendment-related issues. And therefore, all of them, every single blankety-blanking one of them, should, by this compelling logic, forfeit their Second Amendment rights, and maybe by the same token, their bodyguards and Secret Service protection, too. But it does make this point, doesn't it? Oh, what a tangled web we weave. Related issue, this is kind of telling. The historical references here say that the exception shows some British loyalists in the founding era were permitted to carry firearms despite the general prohibition for people that were not trustworthy. And why? Because they took an oath of fealty to the new United States. I guess, folks, the historic precedent is that oaths used to matter. So let's talk next about some of the legal precedents that were referenced in this latest case of the Obama-appointed judge in the Northern District of Illinois, including, first, the one that's called Atkinson v. Garland. That would be the scumbag Merrick Garland, Attorney General. And another somewhat similar case from Pennsylvania called Range v. Attorney General. And I have a piece here from the Harvard Law Review on that score. In the case of Atkinson, again in the Northern District of Illinois, which is why it was important to Judge Coleman, Atkinson was arrested for cocaine possession, and he knowingly possessed a pistol. He believed he had been relieved of his status as a felon, though, and returned to full citizenship after completion of his prison sentence and upon discharge from all required supervision. His belief, says the story, was based on his discharge paperwork that included a notice informing him of the restoration of his civil rights. Not the same, folks, as God-given rights, obviously. That notice included a caveat that the right, sick, to possess a firearm was not restored for persons who'd been convicted of crimes of violence. But because his cocaine sale didn't involve violence, he presumed the restoration of his civil rights was actually complete. He was wrong. And the bottom line from the first pass through the courts was this. The district court concluded that his prohibition on having firearms was presumptively lawful, and furthermore, they concluded that, quote, those who commit serious crimes, whether violent or nonviolent, forfeit their right, oops, to possess firearms. Well, folks, if it's a right, it can't be forfeited unless, of course, they take away your life. So, obviously, then, they meant the privilege to possess firearms. The word right meant something to the founders. They even capitalized it. As you might suspect, the case was later reviewed. There was an appeal, and the Daniel Court looked at the Supreme Court Bruin precedent, which they said leaves no room for doubt. Text and history, not a means-ends analysis, now defined the controlling Second Amendment inquiry. Accordingly, when the Second Amendment's plain text, and we've already talked about this, covers the regulated conduct, well, the government has only one way to defend their unconstitutional regulation, by proving that it's somehow consistent with, quote, this nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation. And here they cite the example of Bruin itself, where the court applied this inquiry to a New York so-called law, turns out it wasn't, that required an applicant, you know, one of the peons, to demonstrate proper cause for the privilege of receiving a permit by Big Brother for the public carry of a firearm. The state's proper cause requirement did not survive, says the story, the court's exacting textual and historical analysis. And they give the citation. And as the petition for writ of certiorari to the U.S. Supreme Court says, regarding Atkinson v. Garland, the Daniel Court simply wasn't persuaded that the government, quote, has met its burden to show a distinctly similar or even relevantly similar historical analog to the alleged statutory permanent prohibition on firearm possession by felons, which basically can only be lifted by an act of Big Brother or Big Brother's gods. It's noted, though, and here I'm quoting, that although Catholics, for example, or enslaved people, and Native Americans were also prohibited from firearm possession, individuals within those groups could possess firearms under certain circumstances. Now, this is really telling, folks, and I'll suggest it's still relevant, whether people want to admit it or not. For example, Catholics who were, quote, willing to swear undivided allegiance to the sovereign were permitted to keep their arms when they pledged allegiance to the United States or a particular state. Enslaved people, too, could possess firearms if, just like today, they had permission from their master. Now, what's also interesting here is that the Garland position, the opposition, was to avoid the Bruin test and its associated analysis altogether. Because felon in possession laws, says Garland, are presumptively lawful. Kind of like election laws and the invasion clauses in the Constitution. They are presumptively non-applicable. And isn't that interesting? Because these same people are presumptively oath-breaking unconvicted criminals. Ponder the irony there. Finally, let's take a look at that Pennsylvania case called Range v. Attorney General, where in August of 95, Brian Range pled guilty to one count of making a false statement to obtain food stamp assistance in violation of Title 62, blah de blah, of the Pennsylvania Consolidated Statutes. His false statement was classified as a first-degree misdemeanor, and under Pennsylvania law, his conviction triggered the application of that federal statute, but Mr. Range maintained he was not informed by the prosecutor or judge that his pleading would result in a lifetime firearm possession ban. And so, unaware that he was barred, Mr. Range attempted to purchase a gun, asking his masters for permission twice. He was unsuccessful both times. I guess if he'd had an FBI handler or was a tranny, it might have been different. But upon further research, he realized his nonviolent conviction precluded him from possessing a gun. So he filed suit in the District Court for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. Up comes Bruin. And this is the part about this one that's interesting. Eventually, the Bruin two-step test was applied, and the Third Circuit reversed and remanded. The majority determined that the Second Amendment applied to Mr. Range, notwithstanding his nonviolent misdemeanor conviction, and the majority acknowledged that the District of Columbia v. Heller case and others stated that only law-abiding citizens and not the people writ large, listen to this carefully, are protected under that Second Amendment thing. And here you might have thought it was an outright prohibition to the central government. How we change subtle little things. The majority discussed how the people is used not only in the Second Amendment, but also throughout the Constitution. So if Mr. Range were not included as part of the people in the Second Amendment context, then he would be precluded from other rights as well. And the majority found that limiting Second Amendment rights to only those who were, quote, law-abiding responsible citizens would be too vague and broad. So the majority ultimately held that Mr. Range was part of the people whom the Second Amendment protected. And result, a declaratory judgment in favor of Mr. Range. Ultimately, his one-time criminal offense for food stamp fraud should not render him permanently non-law-abiding with the loss of his Second Amendment privileges. All right, well, let's see where all of this leads, because most of us are not illegal alien invaders. We didn't come here to overthrow the government of the United States. We aren't convicted criminals, much less felons. Yet, anyway, although the Biden regime certainly intends to try to make as many people into felons and convicted of some crime or another as they possibly can, and guess what? If they manage to turn you into criminals or domestic violent extremists or even white racists or anything else that they come up with that ends in the word phobe, for example, that will certainly be justification in terms of their courts for depriving you of privileges that were once called constitutionally protected rights. How do we deal with that? That's kind of where I want to wrap things up today with, well, at least a few thought experiments. Let's start, of course, with a quote that I think is very important that I've mentioned several times over the last few weeks. It comes from Ayn Rand's famous book, Atlas Shrugged, and it goes right to the heart of what we're talking about today. It says, there's no way to rule innocent men. The only power any government has is the power to crack down on criminals. Well, if there aren't enough criminals, you have to make them. One declares so many things to be a crime that no one can even live without breaking their so-called laws. And if they can declare it to be a crime, folks, and it's not, why not make it a felony? And that way they can get around Bruin or anything else that might come up and declare, you pee on you, you don't have permission, you cannot keep and bear arms, and maybe you can't even live. Because we're going to make you eat bugs, and wait a minute, haven't we been seeing all of this stuff literally playing out before our eyes for years now? One of the things that I think permeates all of this discussion, first with the free speech case, Missouri versus Biden, and also with the Second Amendment cases, has to do with choice of law. So let's talk about the free speech issue, and we'll see how this one plays out. But can Big Brother coerce even his public-private partners? Or will Supreme Court cop out and say, well, coerce is too strong of a word. Big Brother certainly has a right, just like you peons do, to speak his mind, and whether or not he's lying is immaterial. He is, after all, Big Brother. And think about this, too. Who is the creator of those corporate entities? Unlike a living, breathing person who has God-given rights, corporate entities don't have a soul. They are creations of the state, and what the state creates, it regulates. End of story. In other words, U.S. persons that happen to be corporations can't choose, like we can, which God they serve. They serve their Creator and Him alone. The whole issue of how this Missouri v. Biden thing comes out will tell us a lot about whether the court is even bothering to pay lip service to the rule of law anymore. But at least so far, I take heart in the fact that some of these cases are now struggling with the fact that they have created a whole bunch of tests and burdens and, hurdles that they've now literally found themselves entangled in. They really don't want to come out and admit that illegal invaders, migrants, have God-given rights that American citizens have traded away in exchange for a cup of pottage or a socialist safety net. Nope, we've got to be a lot more subtle about it than that. And yeah, you know it, baffle them with BS still works. So it'll be piled higher and deeper. Most people won't get it, and ultimately they'll end up signing up for the Mark of the Beast because they won't recognize just how intimately all of that is entwined with these very same questions. But it really does boil down to a very simple issue, folks, if we understand Scripture. Choose this day whom you will serve. Our Creator has laid before us, and He says so, life and death or blessing and cursing. And the founders got this right for sure. There is no power on this earth that can take the right of individuals to contract and to make that choice as to which God to serve away from you. Oh yeah, they'll try, they'll lie, they'll cheat, and they'll steal, but they cannot take the very choice itself away. We are talking about a choice of law. Whose law is it? And this is the same choice that Yeshua pointed out 2,000 years ago. You can't serve two masters. You'll love one, you'll hate the other. So you better choose. Money or dishonest weights and measures matters too. If we choose His law, we choose His money. Whose image and inscription is on this coin? Or do we not even have coins anymore? Just bits on a computer. In which case, you had darn well better have the master's permission. You could call it his mark in order to access them. Do you see how all of this stuff is intended to and is beginning? You can't deny it to fit together. Again, yes, it seems complicated. And honestly, it does require study of His Word. But once we begin to do so, and we recognize that it hasn't been done away with, no, not one yod or tittle has passed from His instruction, His Torah, His written law, and the other things that go with it, so long as heaven and earth still exist, well, guess what? Now we can begin to see how important it is that we do study to show ourselves approved, recognize what is law and what is, well, nothing except traditions of men masquerading as law, backed up by black-robed priests of another god who may or may not play by the rules, but ultimately, whether they like it or not, they do have to play by His rules because He is the one that wrote the real law, if you will, the supreme law of the land. That choice of law ends up in the mark of the beast, but every choice that we make up until that point points in the very same direction. And it is, in fact, a matter of life and death. So choose wisely, choose this day whom you will serve, and may Yahuwah bless you and yours. Shabbat Shalom.